I'm not going to call anybody a donkey, but let's be honest. There's underperformers out there, and even the best multipliers in the world still have to deal with people that are also underperforming. Have you ever experienced that?
I asked the manager to identify someone who was smart, talented, you know, hardworking, who was an impact player, having extraordinary impact, kind of these superstars in the organization. And then someone that I called a typical contributor, just solid, was doing their job well. And then there was a group that I called not the underperformer, but the under-contributor. And this group was fascinating to me because these were people who were smart. These were hardworking. These were talented people. These were not donkeys. These were like horses racing in the wrong direction. And they were fascinating to me. How many people like were amazing, talented assets to the organization who just were doing their own thing.
The man you've been waiting for, John, the sales machine, Rankin.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest is one of the most sought after executive advisors in leadership space. She is a former executive at Oracle and has also been consistently named one of the world's leading 50 management thinkers in its biannual ranking. Some of her recent clients include Apple, AT&T, Disney, Meta, Google, Microsoft, Nike, Salesforce, Tesla, X, you get it. She is the New York Times bestselling author of Multipliers, The Multiplier Effect, and Wall Street Journal bestsellers Rookie Smarts and Impact Players. Let's welcome her to the show, the CEO of the Wiseman Group, Liz Wiseman.
Well, John, it's so good to be here. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Like I was saying earlier when we were speaking, I read your book in 2010, and literally it transformed our organization using the psychology and the methodology of becoming a multiplier, enrolling people and empowering people to know what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. So, you know, I gotta thank you. I owe you a big thank you because it's been instrumental in the success of our company, Optimo, as well as the sales machine.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you, because if you read it back in 2010, when it first came out, I should be thanking you, because that was back when, like, my mom, my neighbors, you know, the people I cajoled, you know, were reading the book. And it was actually delightful when I started hearing people were reading the book and I didn't know them. Like, people would say, oh, I read your book. Like, yeah, but I didn't ask you to read it. You know? And so you were one of the early adopters of the ideas. So thank you.
You're welcome. So I want to talk about the origination, because, you know, I have a software company now, and, you know, Larry Ellison, right? It built Oracle, and you were at Oracle during his time, right? Tell me about your experience at Oracle, and how was the culture when you initially got involved?
Ooh, Oracle was a phenomenal culture. And, you know, honestly, Oracle was not my number one job I wanted. It was kind of my backup job. I wanted to go teach leadership. So I tried to get a leadership training company. Zanger Miller, they were the premier company at the time, to hire me. And they're like, well, if you want to teach leadership, maybe you should go learn something about leadership first. So I didn't get the job I wanted, but I got this job working for this high-flying, fast-growing, maverick company. They were still relatively small when I joined, a couple thousand people, and an amazing culture. And it had everything to do with who they hired. They, you know, Larry was pioneering the relational database management industry, and not a lot of people knew how to do that because the industry was so nascent. And so they went out and hired a bunch of really smart, young, dumb people. And it was this really wonderful combination of really smart, driven people. So that, like, the hiring profile was raw smarts, achievement orientation, and nice, or nice enough. And then they hired people without experience. So they didn't really understand what was possible or not. That when Larry asked this group of kind of bright go-getters to do something that any reasonable person would say no to. We all said, okay, how high? How far do you want us to jump? Like, okay. And we just jumped in, and it was this amazing place to work. It was this incredible culture. Probably the closest I've come to a meritocracy where, you know, if you were smart and willing to do hard things, there were all these opportunities. But it's actually in that culture that the ideas behind Multipliers was born. And, you know, I'm just enamored with all the really smart people that I'm working around. And I feel really lucky that I get to work around all these really, really smart people. And I noticed that not all of them got to be smart, that some of them had bosses that were so overbearing, so micromanaging, that they didn't get to do much. They didn't get to say much and contribute much. And then I saw other people working for these bosses who gave them a lot of responsibility and a lot of space and expected them to do amazing things. And I watched those smart people really shine. But I was really concerned about the other really smart people who were stagnating. And then I also watched a bunch of really smart people get put into management. And I learned that not all really smart people end up building smart teams and smart organizations, that one's intelligence as a leader can be a tremendous liability for you as a leader, and also this incredible burden for your team. But I also saw people whose intelligence and capability, you know, by intelligence, I don't just mean your IQ. I mean, your know-how, your insights, your skills, like all of that gray matter and all of that knowledge and capability. You know, one's intelligence as a leader can be a tremendous tool for innovation, for growth, for achievement, you know, all these things. And so I was just struck by this difference between how some leaders use their intelligence as a weapon that ended up shutting down others, whereas other leaders used it as a tool. And I got to see that play out over and over again. And, you know, Oracle was full of some of the most amazing leaders, and also some of the worst. Like, they were really smart, but no one got to be smart around them. And I just observed it firsthand as I'm trying to figure out how to lead. I'm trying to be a good leader. And it wasn't until I left the organization that I decided, you know what, this phenomenon, it was not an Oracle phenomenon. It was a everywhere phenomenon. And I think at first I saw it in tech companies, but then I started to see it play out in all sorts of industries. And that's where I decided, you know what, this deserves rigorous research. And so that's what I went to do.
Yeah. And you mentioned a couple of things, and that's really dynamic how one organization can be filled with so many different leaders, and there's pockets of great leaders, and then there's pockets of tyranny. I call it tyranny, right?
Yeah, sure.
People are tyrannical and or they're control freaks, all out of their own fear. But you mentioned a couple of things that really resonate with me. One is the meritocracy piece. Second is how some managers, you know, they want to force everything. For me, hearing that you said it was an amazing culture, was there several cultures within the culture?
Oh, sure. You know, we know this, that a leader's behavior is watched and replicated. You know, it's how imprinting is done, you know, in species and young, is the young are watching the older, the mature of the species, you know, how they operate, how they hunt, how they interact. And they replicate that. And so, you know, within an organization, various leaders, their approach to leadership tends to trickle down to the organization. It's one of the things that I'm so fascinated by, is I'm fascinated by leaders who are countercultural. And I don't mean the jerk leaders who work in really healthy cultures. I mean the really healthy leaders that are working in jerk cultures, where the dominant way of leading is to, you know, be a tyrant, a narcissist, a bully. And that's kind of how things get done. And I love to see the emergence of leaders who choose to operate differently. And in many ways, they're countercultural, organizations have a tendency to shut down countercultural elements and movements within them, unless you're really high performing. And then there's usually exceptions made. Just like high performing jerk bosses tend to survive in really nice organizations, really, really effective leaders like multipliers, they tend to do well in kind of diminishing cultures because they get so much from people. They're high performing. So they're kind of allowed to be culture and countercultural. But I'm fascinated by leaders who choose a different path.
Yeah, and so am I. And so what I call that is buy-in, right? And earlier we were talking about sales, and I think sales starts with me and my leadership. Basically, I have to sell the vision. I have to sell the mission. I have to sell you on why we're actually doing what we do. I mean, even at the Sales Machine, we literally drive performance to help companies increase their sales. And we do that with rewards, recognition, competition, compensation, with levels of development so that they continually grow. That's the environment I want to foster. That's the service I want to provide for other companies, because ultimately it's difficult just to run a company, and you're running your own company. You know that ultimately it's all about people winning. That's the whole key. And we celebrate wins every single day. Like, it's just cultural. What are the red flags? But I want to go back to the situational intelligence. You said, you know, we had so many smart people, and not just talking about IQ. I call it situational intelligence. And there's also an element of social intelligence, because, I mean, a lot of leaders, in my experience, they're really not paying attention, they're not present, or they're really not listening. And a lot of them only listen with their ears rather than seeing what's going on with the individual emotionally. And if they're having a bad day, or, you know, they're not responsive, and or they're not accommodating, or they're not being a team player, you can see that. You can hear with your eyes as well as your ears. And so for me, that's like a little red flag whenever I see different leaders actually interact and potentially, you know, they've got great people, but they might be having a bad day, as an example. What are the little red flags that you see that, or those can be yellow flags, because, you know, it doesn't mean it happens all the time. But what are the little red flags that you see that you think is making the culture toxic, or potentially will make it toxic?
Well, one of the things I see is that creates toxicity in organizations is a gap between what people are able to contribute and what they want to contribute. And I think traditionally we look at it as the gap is that people are able to contribute at high levels because, like, we have systems and we, in some ways, require people to. But what they really want to do is contribute at low levels. But yet somehow with good management, we take, I don't know, B players and make them A players, or we sort of like extract performance from people. That's the way I think a lot of organizations look at this gap between what people are contributing and what they want to contribute. I see it exactly opposite. And it is the thing that I have learned studying some of the best leaders around the world, studying some of the worst, is not every leader is getting everyone's capability. You know, the diminishing leaders we found in our research, we're getting less than half of people's available intelligence, know-how, skills, capability, less than half. Of course, paying full price for that talent, full market value, but getting less than half of people's capability. Whereas these multiplier leaders are getting virtually all of it. There's this big difference between what these leaders get, the multipliers versus the diminishers. But here's what I learned in studying the multipliers and diminishers of the work world is I've come to see that people all around the world, whether they work in Menlo Park in tech, or in the Philippines in tech, or in healthcare or hospitality, people come to work every day desperately wanting to contribute wholly and fully. Like, people come wanting to contribute 100% of their ideas and intelligence. Like, I can't really find anyone who describes a job where they're underutilized as a good job. Like, hey, I've got a good title, maybe even a good salary, a good office, and, you know, a fast laptop, but they don't really expect much of me. I can't find that person. I mean, what people say is, in an environment where they want to contribute 100% of their capability, but they encounter leaders who only see and use a fraction of that, that's what they describe as toxic. You know, that gap between what people naturally want to contribute versus what they're able to contribute. Like, when there's a gap, you tend to see resentment, disengagement, disempowerment, mistrust, toxicity, anger, quitting, you know, or what's worse than quitting, of course, is quiet quitting, when people quit but stay inside the organization. So, you know, that is where they don't leave. Like, if they're going to quit, you want them to leave. But so many people have quit, but yet they stay and they're taking a paycheck. And it's easy to say, well, they don't want to do much. Oh, actually, they do. But when you come to work every day encountering diminishing leaders who are doing all the hard work or are keeping you kind of in a box, like, that's your job, that's your qualification, that's your credential, that's kind of all you can do, you know, people eventually give up trying, but it eats them away inside. So that's one of the red flags, you know, I see in terms of toxic cultures. And, you know, John, you alluded to another red flag. I can't say it's a red flag in the culture. It's more a red flag you see in leaders, is like where their orientation is. And you mentioned situational awareness. And it is what I see with the best leaders, is they are eyes up. They, it's easy to get like heads down, focused on what you have to do, what's on your to-do list, what people are expecting of you, the pressure's on you. But the best leaders are eyes up. They're paying attention to what's going on around them. Gee, so-and-so's quiet. Let me ask them a question. So-and-so seems like they're coasting. Maybe they're due for another challenge. Like, their orientation isn't on self. It's on the ring of people around them. In fact, John, I'll give you, and you know, everyone listening here, particularly if you are a hiring manager and or you're looking to populate your company with multiplier leaders, I'll give you one of my favorite interview questions. This comes to me from the former Tom Friel, the former head of Heidrick & Struggle, global executive search firm. And when he read multipliers, got exposed to the ideas, he said, oh, that's interesting. Those are the kind of executives I was always trying to hire and recruit. And then he gave me his killer interview question. I don't know if he considered it a killer interview question. I do. He said, this is what I used to ask, is he would ask a leader. So he's trying to hire this person out of their current role into head an organization. And so he would say to them, like, tell me about your management team. That was his question. I guess it's not a question, but, you know, like, tell me about your team, the team of people you lead. And I was fascinated to hear what he's listening for. He's actually not really listening for what they say. What he's listening for is how long they talk about their team before the subject returns back to them. See, they're being interviewed for this job. They're a candidate for, you know, a high-profile CEO job. It's very easy for someone to say, oh, yeah, this is my team, but let's talk about me and my accomplishments. He's watching for and listening for, like, where are their eyes? Do they talk about their team like, oh, well, you know what? Let me tell you about John Rankins. He's amazing. You know what? Like, the way he thinks about sales is phenomenal. Like, he's good at this. He does that. We use him here. We, you know, we're there. This is like what he's accomplished. Like, do they really not just know their team, but is their orientation outward? The Arbinger Institute has a new book called The Outward Mindset, which is like this. It's like, can you get your mind off of yourself and focus on the people around you? Because you can't really be good at leading, or John, to your point, good at selling, if your focus is on yourself. You certainly can't be good at teaching. I know that.
I've been doing sales for 30 years, and it started out, I was going door to door selling novelty items, portfolios, and it eventually evolved into services, selling ADT alarms, selling credit cards, and then building an organization to do it. And I had an experience. I started speaking around the world and training sales organizations. I went to Japan. You know, my first gig, speaking gig, they were giving me like $12,000 for a keynote with all these CEOs from Sony, Panasonic. You know, I took $2,000 of it and I bought a new Zanya suit, blue, you know, the IBM cultural. The blue, you know, if you want to impress. Anyway, I get up there on stage and I'm going for about 3 minutes. The CEO of Sony stands up and he starts ranting, right? And there's about 130 of these CEOs in the room, and he starts ranting and he's speaking Japanese and I have no idea what he's saying.
Oh my goodness. I can't imagine how discombobulating that must have been.
Well, and it was my first time in Japan speaking, and one, and then two, it's my first keynote I've ever done.
Yeah. Wow.
They translate back to me because I'm like, what's he saying? And he's like, you know, why should I listen to you? I mean, you're dressed like an average salesperson. We have our own sales organization. And so far, I've heard nothing that's impressed me. And this is like 3 minutes in.
Oh, ouch, ouch, ouch.
And I'm like, he goes, how? I don't think I'm going to learn anything from you. And I said, well, you would be absolutely right. As long as you're not open to learning, you're not going to learn nothing from anyone. All I can say is I'm here to serve you and show you how I built over 1,000 salespeople in different countries around the world. And if you're open to hearing that, how I did it, I'm sure you can get some sort of value. And then he just sat down, and Japanese, who are very reserved, stood up, and I got a standing ovation.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. And John, it's the most un-Japanese thing I've ever heard, but that which is what makes it so remarkable.
Oh, yeah. And I walked off stage. But all my nerves after I said, you know, I'm just here to be of service. After I had said that, all the nerves went away. And I literally walked off stage and I said, you know what? When in service, never nervous. So I know the trick to public speaking, to speaking with anybody and anyone. Don't make the focus about me. Come from service and you'll never be nervous. And this is what Zig Ziglar says about sales. That's why I say, Liz, you are a badass salesperson because you have enrolled leaders. You have sold leaders on becoming multipliers. You had a huge effect on my life and my organization. And this is 2010, right? So I would say that, you know, you have remarkable sales skills when you come from service.
Well, and, you know, I do think, I mean, it is true that the ideas in multipliers have been of incredible service to millions of leaders around the world. And that, you know, and that feels good. And it comes when you share ideas, not to draw attention to yourself necessarily, but there to really teach and to help people. And you're right. It does change everything. And I'm not trying to change the subject on us. We'll get back to this idea of leading as multiplier, but in the research I did for this book, Impact Players, I looked at essentially what was on the other side of the coin. You know, I had been running around for a decade, helping leaders be the kind of leaders who used people's full intelligence, help people be successful, have influence, make an impact. And it was in that process, somebody said, well, yeah, that's great. I want to be a multiplier, but you can't multiply zero. And I'm like, oh, And I'm about to give this guy this big speech about like, hey, you know, like, okay, maybe not everyone on your team is a genius, but everyone has genius and your job as a leader to figure that out. And I realize he's talking about something totally different. He's like, yeah, I have to show up with the right mindsets and attitudes, but so do the people who work for me. Like they've got to show up with the right orientation as well. You know, like you got to bring something to the table for your boss to work with. And so I spent a couple years studying the most impactful contributors inside of organizations, contributors at all different levels. And what I found, you know, it's all written up in this book, but like I would boil a lot of it down to they operate with a service mentality. And they operate with very, very high degrees of situational awareness. So there are people who are doing their job heads down, like this is my job and I'm going to do my job. And then there are the impact players who are like, I'm here to serve and I'm a problem solver, not a clinical research coordinator or a junior sales rep or a global account management. Like I'm here to serve. And so that allows them to be kind of rangy with their job boxes, you know, the org charts, then job descriptions that we slot people into. They're like, I'm going to kind of go where I need to get the job done. And that service orientation is what allows them to navigate and to work where they can add value and impact. And it is, you know, I'm thinking of an experience I had at Oracle, and it was one of the more not sassy. I don't know if that I would call it sassy. Maybe ballsy might be the right term, but yeah, I had been at Oracle for a good decade. I had a lot of credibility. I had a really senior job. I worked really closely with the top executives, the management committee. I was, you know, kind of seen as an influential person. I worked very closely with the president. And the president hired a new member of his staff. He actually came from the military. And he was the like chief of staff kind of thing. And so he kind of sat me down and explained to me that he was like the new chief of staff and that anything that I wanted Ray, the president, to review or look at or weigh in on should go through him. And I listened to him and I'm like, that sounds really bureaucratic. That sounds like that's going to slow me down. That sounds like this dude's bringing bureaucracy to an entrepreneurial kind of place. And I listened and he was like, so I'm going to be your person. Like you do everything through me. And I remember looking at him and saying, Mike, I need to let you know that I have no intention of working that way. Like, I understand you and I understand what you're saying and why you would say that, but I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm going to work with whoever I need to get this job done and to do the kinds of things that the company needs done. And I won't misuse their time. And you're always welcome to join that conversation. I'll copy you on every email, any meeting I schedule with the president, like you are welcome to attend, but I'm not going to go through you. And I remember him just being like, like shocked at this, but I think like it wasn't me trying to be, wasn't a power move. It was just saying like, you're messing with my vibe here on like doing the right thing. And it is this notion of when you're there to serve, but not to aggrandize, it's just, it's easy to kind of bat away like all the noise. And that to me, what he was suggesting was noise. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. And I wasn't going to lie to him like, oh yeah, okay, Mike, you know, I'll work that way. I'm like, no, I need to let him know. I'm not going to do a passive aggressive thing. I'm going to tell him to his face, like, I will not comply with this. But it came from very much a service orientation.
Hey, I get it. And you know, I've worked with companies all over the world, even outside my company. And it's, to me, because I'm from the sales orientation and that's what I've been doing, building and scaling sales teams for more than 30 years. I look at, you know, as soon as I go into an organization, I get invited in. I look at, all right, what, first of all, what's your value proposition, right? How are you doing risk reversal with your products, your services, and then, you know, are your people sold on, because the first person they have to sell is themselves on your products and services. And when I look at different organizations and different methodologies, I consistently see that companies have three big problems. And number one is they don't have enough leads, right? They just don't have enough customers or enough people coming in. And then if they have enough leads, they don't have enough sales, as an example. And, you know, unless you're enterprise level and you've built it for 20 years, but then you could be redundant overnight. I mean, ask Kodak, right? Ask all these, you know, ask Blockbuster. But the third thing that companies are challenged with is performance. So in your experience, when you go into these different kinds of companies, I mean, they, you know, lead marketing and sales, different gig. The third thing is performance, right? Having accountability. What do you think is the best way to drive performance and get accountability?
Well, I have no expertise in how you structure sales quotas or spiffs or rewards or compensation. Like I really don't have any expertise on those levers. But what I could offer is, like, what is it that leaders can do in the way they lead their teams that is going to create a performance culture? And I would, it's kind of a pairing of things. It's a pairing of trust and ownership. And they really go together. Like, if you want people to perform at high levels, they have to feel like they own their own performance. And I think a lot of leaders feel like they can own things and they can dangle things in front of people like, well, here's your quota. It's arbitrary, but here you go. You know, here are your resources. Here are your teams. And they give people a set of things that are completely out of their control. And when that happens is people go through the motions. But, you know, it's kind of, what is that saying that nobody ever washed a rental car? You know, we don't tend to take care of things we don't own. Or maybe that's just me and trying to convince my teenage and young adult sons, like, to maybe take better care of our family's assets and things. But, like, you see this.
No, that's a great analogy. That's a great analogy. Nobody washes a rental car. I absolutely love that. Because ultimately, if they don't value it. And if you don't give them the responsibility and put them into the role and give them what they need, they'll never take ownership and you'll never drive the performance.
Yeah. And so, we take care of things we own and we grab on to things that we own. And so, like, if you want to increase performance, you have to give people ownership. And sometimes that is some influence on setting the right goals. Influence on how they do things, how to break the rules, whatever. But sometimes it's just letting go of ownership. I find that there's something common that a lot of managers tend to do. It has everything to do with handing the pen. Like, let's assume pen represents control or ownership, a piece of work. And let's say, John, maybe you're on my team and I'm like, John, hey, you know, we've got this new initiative. I want you to lead it and I want you to take responsibility for it. It's yours. And I hand the pen to you. Yeah. And then you go to grab it, but I failed to let go of it. And then, you know, I'm having a conversation, the pillow talk, you know, at home that I might be having, like, you know, with my roommate, for my case, it's my husband. I'd be like, you know what? I put John in charge of this, but he's not, like, running with it. Like, I'm going to all the meetings. He keeps asking me for my approval on things. And I really want him to take charge. But the problem is I haven't let go of it. And, you know, kind of back to this notion of ownership, you know, if when you buy a house, at least, you know, kind of in the North American world that I'm in, like you go to buy a house, you go to the title company and you take ownership of a house by signing the title. But before you sign and get title to that house, somebody has had to sign and release title. Like, you can't take ownership of that home or that asset until somebody releases ownership. And, you know, a lot of managers want to hold on to the pen and have somebody take ownership. And you know, my view is like, no, it's got to be like a transfer of title, which is, John, it's yours. I let you take over. I let go. And then, like, for other people to own it, you as a leader have to not own it. And I don't mean you kind of hang people out to dry or, you know, turn your back on people. I mean, you've got to give someone like what I call the 51% of the vote. You have to say, you are in charge, not me. You're not here to help me with this thing I'm in charge of. I'm here to help you be successful with this thing you're in charge of. And when people are in charge of things, then they tend to perform at their best. So, you know, infused in this is a culture of trust, but this transfer of ownership.
I love it. And, you know, I've also read, have you read the book about Zappos?
I haven't.
Yeah. So, I mean, they have a crazy culture. People come in, they dress like freaks every day, costumes. And the founder, I believe it's Tony Hsieh, he passed. Anyway, he lets people do whatever they want to do and work the hours they want to work as long as they can solve the problems for customers. But the entire culture is about ownership, about you take ownership of anything and everything you need to do to get somebody a pair of shoes. Yeah. And if you can't find the shoes at our company, get them from another company, send them to another company, always make them happy. And it's an amazing culture in Vegas. So I love that. And that really does empower people and organizations to scale, because lack of, like we talked about, the quiet quitting. And a lot of people interpret quiet quitting as someone just resigns and they leave. But in actuality, I love how you've pointed out that it's actually the quiet quitting happens and they don't leave. They don't resign. They're just sitting there. So what has been your experience? Because I've heard people say, like the guy said, you can't multiply zero. That was probably one of the funniest things I've heard in a long time. Because a lot of people put the wrong people or the right people in the wrong position. But at the end of the day, what that guy was saying is you cannot make a donkey a racehorse. You can put a donkey in a horse race, but it's never going to win, ever, because it just doesn't have what it takes. It's not at that level and or doesn't have the proper skills and training. What have you ever dealt with organizations? Because I myself don't like saying, you know, I'm not going to call anybody a donkey, but let's be honest. There's underperformers out there, and even the best multipliers in the world still have to deal with people that are also underperforming. Have you ever experienced that?
Well, all the time. And, you know, I think when I did this last research project, I was really clear in what I was trying to study. I asked managers to identify three types of contributor. One we called the impact player, all of these people in these three categories were people who were smart, hardworking, talented. But yet I asked the managers to identify someone who was smart, talented, you know, hardworking, who was an impact player, having extraordinary impact, kind of these superstars in the organization. And then someone that I called a typical contributor, just solid, was doing their job well. And then there was a group that I called not the underperformer, but the under contributor. And this group was fascinating to me because these were people who were smart. These were hardworking. These were talented people. These were not donkeys. These were like horses racing in the wrong direction. And they were fascinating to me. How many people like were amazing, talented, you know, assets to the organization who just were doing their own thing or working hard in the wrong direction or working on their passion rather than the purpose of the organization. And that kind of underperformer, like someone who's under-contributing relative to their potential, that is someone who can be redirected with good leadership, with someone who's like, you know what? Okay, over here, this is what I need you to do. This is what you're brilliant at. This is what we need done. Like, over here, make this happen. You know, people with just an ounce of good leadership could really become superstars and impact players in organizations. So, you know, I don't think we should just assume that, okay, well, like that dog don't hunt. And so, you know, they're of no value. It's more like, what are they good at? And how do we find, like, not everyone is a genius, but everyone has something that they're good at. And like, what is that person good at? And can we get them, I guess, to use your metaphor, like the donkey's not a racehorse, but maybe they're like a workhorse. And so what is a role that utilizes what they're good at? And then people who are extraordinarily talented, who could be good at so many things, might need more direction, more clarity, less tolerance, maybe being held accountable. And I think with good leadership, I think a lot of performance problems can be addressed. Now, with all that said, I am in no way suggesting that a leader or manager tolerate a prolonged performance problem. If someone can't be directed, redirected, moved into a better role, like if they just persist, they need to leave the organization. Because not only are they underperforming in that job and doing damage to the business, to the customers, they're doing damage to a team. Because when we can't hold them accountable, yeah, it's not just like the lack of performance, it's the messaging that gets sent through the organization, which is like, oh, it's okay to underperform here. And, you know, the message we send, which is, well, it's okay, I'll take it on myself as a leader. And it actually pushes leaders down a diminishing path. It builds toxicity and resentment into the culture. Like, this is well documented what happens when we do this.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of the NFL and teams. And I love, like, I watch the NFL draft. I watch the off season. I watch the OTAs. And then I watch all the games. My favorite team is the Pittsburgh Steelers. Come on. The head coach, Mike Tomlin, he always says, and it's on all the walls, the standard is the standard. And, you know, they have to uphold the standard. And there's nowhere to hide. Like in the NFL, you're,
well, people will be injured if you don't do your job.
Yeah, and not only that, if you don't do it at the highest level, there's thousands of people
who want to do that job, yeah.
Right. So for me, the standard is the standard. So I think for I what made a big difference for me, understanding my own style of leadership early on wasn't working. And nor did I want to be a tyrant or, you know, a dysfunctional leader. For me, leadership is, you know, you got to have a vision. That's number one. You have to have a mission. You have to be able to communicate that and sell that to the organization and enroll people. But then you also have to bring out the best in each one of your people. And that's what you're saying as far as putting the right people in the right place. And if they don't do the work, then, you know, you got to, everybody in the organization should be moving forward, onward, upward, or out. That's my philosophy.
And John, to that point, you know, the standard is the standard, but not everyone hits a standard the first time. And one of my very dear friends, mentors, a former boss, he's passed now, Kerry Patterson, who wrote the Crucial Conversations series of books, and amazing researcher and author. I remember once hearing him describe how they train a killer whale, like, you know, the the circus performers of the whales. Like you go down to these aquatic shows and you see these whales jump, I don't know, 50 feet out of the water and ring the bell. Like, of course, that didn't happen at one try. You know, the trainer didn't say, well, this is the standard. You jump and you get fish or you don't. And if you can't hit the standard, you're out. Like people are trained, like the whale is trained and reinforced for movement in the right direction. And, you know, the standard doesn't change. Like this is what we need. This is the performance we're training toward, but you get there incrementally.
I agree 100%. Even in the sales machine, we have a training center. Like there's a smart framework. It's like having five modules: sales, marketing, achievements, retention, and training. Like this is our software. It has achievements in there and it has a training center. So like in the NFL, there's a practice squad. You can have like 16 players and they're literally training all the time until they level up their skills. And for me, the organization is only going to grow to the level of the training systems you have. I 100% agree with you. Yet, and even on my walls, you know, I copied it. The standard is the standard because, you know, the only way to create greatness within the organization is to bring out the best in everyone. Yet sometimes, you know, even recently, I realized one of my teams, and I take ownership of this and responsibility for it. One of my tech teams, and, you know, tech teams are made up of several teams. There's the product management team. There's the QA team. There's the development team. But one of my tech teams said, we get it. We understand the standard is the standard. And I'm like, okay, so if we have a sprint and we're falling behind, it's less than 70%. Would you call that pass or fail? And they're like, yeah, it's failing. And I'm like, okay, good. So how do you bring up the standard? What are the elements of the standard? Of the standard is the standard. And none of them could answer. And I said, that, you know what, guys? That's my bad. So there's activity. So what determines the standard is the standard is the quantity of activity, number one, the quality of the activity, and then the consistency. So we fell behind, and I fell behind by not allowing you guys to understand that, because we should be able to manage, track, and measure, align, and reward everything we're doing in the organization. So even me, I took a step back and I said, okay, guys, now you go back and find out from your teams how you can implement the standard as the standard by what is the quantity of activities, the quality, and the consistency that you're going to need to perform at the highest level. And everybody was cool. They're like, oh, this is great. Now we understand what is the standard is the standard. Because it's one thing to make a statement. It's another thing to give them a framework.
Yeah. And it's a little awkward to say like that poster on the wall. I'm not sure I understand it. So it's good. It's good that you backtracked on that.
That I need to retrain. I need to retrain. I got to get Liz Wiseman on the show. I need to retrain. No, but I, you know, it's amazing how I read your book 14 years ago and now you're on the show and it's helped me so much. Like it's, to me, that's just crazy. Don't you think that's crazy?
Well, you know, it is. And it's kind of what happens when people stay at things. And I once had some feedback on like a 360 and I remember it because it stung. It said, like, it's hard to know, like, which of Liz's parades to get behind because they don't all make it to the finish line. And, you know, what I realized is I was starting more than I was finishing. And that it's hard to get behind people if things fizzle out. And, you know, part of that is just the reality of corporate life. Not every initiative you start, like, you know, yields success. But, you know, with some of these, the research and the books, like I've been at it for a long time and you just keep sharing the message. You keep helping leaders and then it spreads and it grows. And you've been doing the same thing, just getting better as a leader and staying at it and iterating and getting good. And, you know, magic things happen when people iterate and learn and stay at things.
Yeah. Do you have a story about some of the different leaders you've worked with that have went from being tyrannical and or diminishers and have turned into multipliers?
Oh, dozens, hundreds. Oh, yeah. I've seen incredible transformations all around the world. I've seen school districts transformed. I just saw one came in just a few weeks ago, someone who just shared multipliers. She was a new superintendent school district in Minnesota, Missouri, and shared multipliers with her team. They studied the book. They set some objectives. They put it in their development plan. They stayed at it. And like 18 months later, they're seeing massive changes in like school climate surveys and employee engagement and community engagement and reading scores and math scores, and all of these indicators across the district are going up. Because she just said, this is the kind of leadership like our city schools deserve. And if you can't do it, she moved people out. She said, this is how we're going to lead. We're going to be multipliers. And stayed at it. That was just a couple weeks ago, but I've seen individuals transform, companies transform.
Yeah, and you work with the top companies in the world. I mean, when we talk about Apple, Google, X, all of these different organizations, is it different every time when you go in and they call you in?
Well, I think anyone who's in a sales role knows that anytime you're working with a client, there's part of what they do that is very unique to them. And you have to understand that and address it and treat it. And then there are some problems that are just universal challenges and problems. And people tend to feel like, oh, we're really unique here. This is like, you know, people are people. And so there are some things that are not unique challenges. But that's, I think, part of like the mastery that comes in teaching and consulting and selling, is like knowing like really what is unique and different and special, and how to dial in a message, a solution. But yeah, no, we've worked with some amazing, amazing organizations. I've worked with amazing leaders and have learned so much from so many of these leaders.
Yeah. And have you ever had an experience? Because, I mean, you've worked with so many diversified organizations. I mean, you just talked about a school district, not just the biggest companies in the world. Have you ever dealt with resistance when you're brought into these different organizations to implement the change?
There's the natural resistance that comes when people have to confront what they're doing and decide if it's effective or not. There is a natural human resistance to growth and to change, like inertia. So that's the resistance. But usually, and honestly, by the time that I get brought into an organization, I'm not trying to convince them of anything. They're already convinced, and they want help. They want to learn.
Right. And a lot of those companies you work with are multi-billion dollar companies. But for, you know, a lot of our listeners out there, you know, whether they're a startup or, you know, a small, medium enterprise business, what are some practical steps they can do besides reading your book? Because, and I suggest everybody read your books. Practical steps, if they don't have your book, that you would say that will get them on the right path.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad first step to read the book, but you know, I am in no way wanting to push a book. Like, I can't read every book that someone has suggested I read. But there's a pretty easy entry point to some of the ideas. We have a quiz on our website. It's called "Are You the Accidental Diminisher?" And it's like a 3-minute leadership assessment. But we have had so many, hundreds of thousands, you know, I don't know, maybe 1 million people take this quiz and say it's been extremely helpful to them, because it helped people see not the tyrannical, raging diminisher maybe that lurks inside of them. Maybe some people are, but it will help people see the way they might be diminishing with the very best of intentions. Maybe they've got some rescuer tendencies. Maybe they're a pace setter. Maybe they're overly optimistic, but it'll help people see the ways the things they're doing with noble intentions, like trying to be supportive, trying to be encouraging, trying to be positive, helpful, trying to hold the high standards that end up creating a diminishing effect and can erode contribution and performance and capability and initiative and all these things. It's not a bad starting point. And once you do that, you know, the quiz will give you some recommendations on, hey, try some of these practices. But probably the most powerful thing anyone can do is to talk with their team very openly about their accidental diminisher tendencies. Like, oh, I'm a bit of a rescuer. When I see people struggling, like I'm big-hearted and I want people to be successful. So I jump in, I help save the deal, or I help, you know, and to talk about the ways that that causes people to shut down. And here's the promise, is that what feels like it might be an awkward conversation turns out to be a delightful conversation. And in cultures that I would never think would have fun with this conversation, tend to have fun with this conversation because it's based in what the leader is doing with the best of intent. And once the leader talks openly about their accidental diminisher tendencies, then the burden of them trying to constantly be on vigil to watch for diminishing moments and try to turn those into multiplier moments, that burden is now shared with their team, and their team can help prevent diminishing leadership in real time. Meaning, like, John, if I work for you and you're a bit of a rescuer and you tell me that, and we all tease you about that, when it's the final hour of a big project and I'm struggling with something and you step in and you offer to help, it gives me the ability to say, hey, John, I appreciate the offer, but you know what? I've got this. And I'm getting this thing across the finish line. And you know what? You just stay put. You can be there. Like when I cross the finish line, you can celebrate here. And, you know, it helps people guide their leaders to be the best kind of leaders they can. That's a really powerful starting point.
Liz, you're hired. You're an amazing woman. I love all of, you know, this to me is like your life work. Like when I, and the passion you put into those pages and the frameworks and doing all the work, it's just, it's really refreshing. And it helps. It's helped me tremendously understand human psychology and how to empower and enroll people to get them to do what they want to do and take ownership. Because for me, I mean, I came from a culture, lead, follow, or get out of the way. Hmm. And that's very much a militaristic approach. And it's autocratic. And I'm going to go all the way around to when we began this conversation. And you talked about the amazing culture at Oracle. And you said it was like a true meritocracy. Because a lot of people don't even understand that there's different leadership styles and or different cultures, whether it be autocratic, socratic, or I don't even know if you call it meritocratic, but I implemented a lot of socratic leadership, and I was challenged by giving too much and enrolling people to take ownership, but they were not always the right people, and they turned into being toxic and or dropping the ball and not and or taking credit for everything away from the team. So in your experience of, you know, all the different organizations, how do you create meritocracy and find that balance?
Well, as a leader, I think for starters, you don't play favorites. And that's easy to say. It's very hard to do. You know, I've always had my favorite people on the team that I love to work with. But when you have favorites, you're not going to create a meritocracy, because what you're saying is actually what wins in the end is the boss's favorite, the pet. So it's getting beyond that. It's helping people see. I mean, it's obviously all the things we've talked about to help people do their best work. But then, you know, to make sure people see this line of sight between their work and the impact it has. You know, if you're in sales, you see a direct connection between your commission check and your effort. But for so many people, they're doing the work, but they're not seeing the results of that. And it's not about money. It's about impact, like help people see their impact. You know, create a culture where different forms of genius are valued, where it doesn't matter your age, your gender, your education, that instead of looking at people's skills and qualifications, look at what I call people's native genius, what they do easily and freely, and put that to work. And those are all, those are bureaucracy busters and they're meritocracy builders.
Yep, same. So where can people go and take these assessments, get your books, find you, because they need to. So many organizations out there are struggling.
I'm so easy to find. I'm easy to find on social media. The website is thewisemangroup.com. There's a tab there for the books. Books are easy to find. Amazon, they're all over the place. So,
right on. Thank you very much. Pleasure, honor, mad respect I have for you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to send a review about what you liked on this podcast or share it with somebody who would need it to definitely improve their business, building and scaling sales teams, do me a favor, like, share. It means a lot to me so that we can help others grow and live in abundance. That's a wrap, folks. Thanks for joining me today. And if you got value from this episode, do me a favor. Like, subscribe, and refer a friend. And if you want even more value, go to thesalesmachine.com, click on resources, and there's tons of resources there to increase profits and drive performance in your business. Right on, right on. Come on.